thanks for tuning in to On the Same Page, a new podcast from the Jefferson Madison Regional Library to keep you in the loop and on the same page about what's happening at your library. Hi, welcome back. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of On the Same Page. We're your hosts, Abby
and Erica,
librarians at the Central Library.
I am listening to a book called Zoom by the author Bob Berman. It's a few years old and it deals with motion. He talks about fastest animals. He talks about motion around the earth, kind of like tides and currents and air currents and volcanoes.
Oh, yeah. The discussion about tides inspired me to look up
more
information about tides.
Yeah, I've been texting Abby a lot of tidbits. Last night I sent her the fact that Tahiti has no tide because they are so centrally located in like the ocean currents.
Yeah, so then I looked it up to see if it was just a product of them being isolated in the middle of the Pacific Ocean away from big landmass. No, the answer is no. There are several places around the Earth where there are no tides, but that's the only place that happens to coincide with the exact location of an island. So other places are near, but they have, like, minimal tides.
Yeah.
It's so interesting. So Tahiti is unique in that respect.
Right. It makes me want to go to Tahiti.
Yeah.
I was also, and this one's a little gross. Not very many people were found actually still in Pompeii covered in lava because they tried to escape.
We're talking about the
Mount Vesuvius explosion.
Something BC.
Was it BC?
Wasn't it?
I don't know. That covered Pompeii and killed most of the people who lived there. So he was saying that's lava is what we think of when we think of volcanoes, and we think people who get killed by volcanoes get killed by this fast-moving lava because it does move fairly quickly, but actually... The thing that moves fastest is the cloud of gas. That's inescapable. And so there were a variety of bodies discovered in the excavation.
AD 79.
Yeah, it was very close.
So it wasn't BC.
The excavation, they found bodies that were missing the tops of their skulls. And it was actually because the heat in that cloud is so high that their brains boiled and exploded.
That's bonkers. Oh my gosh.
So disturbing, it makes me giggle.
Yes. It seems like a sci-fi effect.
Yes, it seems like something you see in a movie that they would make up to, like, get rid of Nazis.
Right.
So anyway, I'm really enjoying this book. And the reason I picked it up was because I was looking at the new books that were coming in, and I saw this author's newest book, Zapped, but I had to wait for it because there were holds, so I went looking... to see if he had any others, and he did, and so I got Zoom out, and I've been listening to it, and it's very entertaining.
Sounds great.
Yeah, The Reader is great. I'm really entertained. I love these books, especially because, like...
It makes learning fun.
What else did I send you? I was, like, making a list.
Bananas are full of radiation.
Eating a banana will give you more exposure to radiation than living next to a nuclear power plant for a year.
Another fun fact that you sent me was that if and when we colonize Mars, the Martian colonists... may receive so much radiation over just a few years that it could destroy 30 to 40% of their brains.
Yeah, they're not sure. This is part of the banana thing. He was just talking about what things give off radiation and why some things that we might think are unsafe are safer than we expect, and other things like bananas, which we think are more benign. And they're not like highly radioactive at all. They're just like, it's a higher load than you might expect. And he starts talking about radiation coming from space and through space and all the different particles and... how when you're on an exposed planet like Mars, with no atmosphere, you might be more susceptible to damaging radiation. It's a great book, and you should check it out.
Also may want to rethink your career plans as a Martian pioneer.
Right. The other book I'm reading, and I've had to take it very slow because it's got a lot of angsty content because it's a young adult novel, is Turtles All the Way Down by John Green. It's John Green's latest. It is... if you like John Green, this is at his normal caliber, and it's very good.
Expect long hold lists.
Yeah, exceptionally long hold lists. It's been getting, like, starred reviews, and he's supporting it with a really big tour with his brother. But it's about a girl who, she has kind of obsessive thought spirals that she gets trapped in, and I think it's a product of anxiety I think hers stems from the loss of her father at a young age. John Green has been very open and honest in his real life. He has a similar struggle that he has dealt with all of his adult life. And I think his depiction of that is really good. It's very realistic. And then I found myself being like, sometimes that happens to me.
So very relatable.
Yeah, which was hard because it is so heavy. Like, she's dealing with this mental illness that even though she's receiving therapy and being medicated for, it still consumes a large part of her energy. And even people who care about her can't fix that for her. That's just the nature of mental illness. And at the same time, she's a teenager, so she's doing normal teen things like hanging out with her best friend and having romantic encounters with cute boys. And I'm about halfway through that, and it is really good, but like I said, I am taking it slow because you can really get sucked into these. And if you can't make it all the way to the end, it's just like a lot of heavy until you get there. I expect a semi-happy ending.
I feel like his books usually end on a bittersweet note that are heavier on the sweet.
Yeah, they're realistic. Like, the guy doesn't always get the girl, and not every character survives, depending on which book you're reading.
I feel like most books, somebody doesn't make it to the end. I mean, most John Green books.
Yeah.
At least in recent
years. So you have to be prepared for that. And I've had a coworker tell me that while this book is phenomenal, it's also, there's a couple things coming that I don't know what they are. He just said, yeah, there's a couple parts. And I was like, ah, I guess I'll find out. Because you don't want to ruin the book. John Green's a masterful storyteller.
Oh, he's so talented. He's so great at manipulating you emotionally. He's like really, really skilled at it. And I mean that in the best way.
Yeah, if I didn't.
As the best authors are.
If I wasn't so familiar with him, because he has such a great online video presence. Mm-hmm. And he seems like such a great guy, such a nice person. So intent on making sure everyone knows they're of value and
right.
Welcome, then I would think he was doing it on purpose maliciously.
Right. No, he just...
He can string a story.
Yes. Okay, so this episode we have something super cool. It's a little unusual. It's almost like a lecture from local retired educator and historian. And military history fan, William Walker. We brought him to the Central Library on Sunday, October 22nd, to talk about his book, Betrayal at Little Gibraltar, which is about the Muzargon offensive in World War I.
That's true.
Yes. And we were able to offer this great program, and he was kind enough to let us record it so that we could offer it on the podcast as well. And it was recorded as a part of the World War I in America 2-year national initiative of the Library of America, which was presented in partnership with the Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History, the National World War I Museum and Memorial, and other organizations, with generous support from the National Endowment for the Humanities. So basically, this is a grant that we were lucky enough to get to take part in and bring wonderful programs like this talk.
Yeah, it celebrates the centennial of America's involvement in World War I, and it is working to provide a discussion of the American veteran experience, the American war experience through the lens of World War I and what people experienced there. It involves a book called The World War I in America Reader that has a lot of news coverage and other writings from very popular authors, including Edith Wharton and Robert Frost, about their experiences traveling through Europe during World War I or covering for a newspaper, the fighting.
Yes, and so we have a lot of copies of this book in our system. We'll put a link to it in our show notes. But it's one of the things that makes it so great is there are also writings by World War I veterans included. So they're talking about their own experience of the war.
Yeah, and it starts at the beginning. As America as a country didn't get involved until 1917, but the book covers kind of the political side of things over here and why we were trying not to, and some of the letters from heads of state or to heads of state from our government. And
it covers a lot of kind of different frameworks for looking at the war. It, you know, talks about sort of the home front, if you will, like the war in American culture, or like the impact on people at home. It talks about women's experience in World War I.
Definitely. And we were very...
isolationist?
Yeah.
you'll hear in Bill Walker's talk, he talks about all the sort of political movements or repercussions that came out of the war at the end, and how there was kind of an upswing in isolationism and nationalism, which of course, you know, led directly into World War II.
And that's what kind of kept America out for a while, is how much we didn't want to be the global police force, and we didn't want to get involved in a war that we didn't feel was ours. And obviously the sinking of the Lusitania changed that for us. Also, some Americans didn't agree with our national stance. These were young men. They felt like they could prevail on the side of justice, and they went to Europe looking for a way to get into the fighting, so they would join the French Foreign Legion or something similar, and they would be put on the front lines immediately. So some Americans were fighting right. The entire war.
Right.
And you read their experiences as well in this reader. So we were really excited to have Bill Walker come join us. We were able to hear him speak when he was in town about 6 months ago for the Festival of the Book.
And Eric and I, neither of us are really like military history buffs, but we sat in on his talk and we're just like, oh my gosh, I want to know more. I've never felt that way about a military history book before.
Especially about one particular offensive, but he's a very engaging speaker, and we were very glad to find out that he is so talented at sharing these stories.
And he's telling a story about World War I you've never heard. It's like counter to the dominant narrative of the U.S.'s involvement in the war, I think, or...
Which fits in perfectly with this grant and the reader that accompanies it, because that is what the reader is made up of. Stories you may not have heard, different types of experiences. So that's the brief introduction to the talk you're about to hear. And we hope you really enjoy the expertise of William Walker.
This is William Walker. I start off with this statement by T.S. Eliot. The communication of the dead is tongued with fire beyond the language of the living. And I think my experience over the past 20 years has certainly proved that. One winter day when I was working at the college, Gettysburg College, I was looking for a map. I had an uncle who was killed in World War I, and I wanted to find out where he'd been killed. Opened this book, it was a rather large book, and I began to notice that there was a lot of marginalia on the sides of the pages, and it was written by the man who owned the book, who was a major in this World War I battle. It actually is the largest battle in American history, called the Meuse-Argonne Campaign. It involved 1.2 million Americans, and it's also the bloodiest. More people were killed in this battle than even D-Day or the Battle of the Bulge. At any rate, I began to see this marginalia, and I grew interested in it. And as I read on, the gentleman who was writing this, whose name is Harry Parkin, began to be quite angry. And it was clear that he had participated in the battle and didn't think that it was run in the same way. I reached one page, and it said, if you want to know the truth about this battle, turn to page 638. And I turned back, and this man had written, I call it an affidavit. He was trained in the law, Harry was, at Harvard, and he charges a major general by the name of Robert E. Lee Bullard from Alabama with disobeying orders that were given to him by Pershing and Pershing staff. And he said in a summary way, Bullard received the high military decorations of England, France, Belgium, and the U.S. What he deserved was a long term in military prison for killing hundreds of American troops. That this disobedience to the orders had killed a bunch of American troops. Harry Parkin was a Pittsburgher. He got an A.B. from Harvard in 1904, same class that Franklin Roosevelt was in. I don't think that Mr. Parkin ran with the same people that Franklin Roosevelt ran with, but he was a wealthy fellow, came from a wealthy family, and he went to law school for a year until he got bored by it. He said, I can't take this, and went back to Pittsburgh and got involved. Even though he was in an advanced age when World War I came along, he felt that he needed to volunteer and go, and he did. He took officer's training, and when he came out, he was so respected that they didn't make him a second lieutenant, they made him a captain. And he was assigned as a company commander in the 79th Division. 79th was part of the lowest rank in the pecking order of the Army. There were regular Army units, National Guard units, and then National Army units. And he was in this National Army unit that was made up of men from Pennsylvania, Maryland, and D.C. He was in the thick of things. He attacked the strongest part of the line when the event took place. Later, he attacked another very strong place on a hill that the Germans were using as an observatory. And he was shot four times, captured by the Germans, carried off into captivity, but only for a few days, because the war was about over when he was captured. He won the Distinguished Service Cross because he was a very brave sort of fellow, and the Legion of Honor from France. He was kept overseas for about a year because of his injuries. He had to have a lot of operations. He became obsessed with Montfaucon and Bullard and spent the rest of his life. He had a huge collection of military books and actually had collected things from the Napoleonic Wars. He had all uniforms, helmets that Bonaparte had used. Now, what I had to do is to figure out how to make a decision whether or not I would pursue this, because I knew it would take a long time. So how do you do that? Let me just bring you up to date so you'll remember. In 1918, Europe had been at war for 4 years. France, Britain, and Germany were worn out. They'd exhausted their manpower. Their economies were depleted. Russia had bailed out of the war because of the revolution. And all of the armies were nearing 10 million casualties. Now, that's wounded and killed. The Americans are landing, and the Germans have just finished their spring offensives in 1918. And they failed. They made one last run at capturing Paris. So General Foch, who was the supreme commander of the Allies, decided that he would try a new tactic, and that was to have offensives mounted by all of the armies at his command at the same time. And in a way, what had happened in World War I was almost what happened in the Civil War here. There would be one big offensive in one part of the U.S., and then after they'd killed enough men, they would back off and rest for a couple of months. His idea was to mount all of these offensives and go right at the Germans. The Americans had the toughest one and the most promising one. They had to go through the toughest area of the land. It was like the Blue Ridge Mountains. And then go 35 miles and cut a rail line that the Germans had. And if they cut that, it would have cut 50% of the supplies off of the German Western Front. So if they did that, they would win the war. It would be over. But there were natural obstacles, and it was heavily fortified by the Germans. Here's what some of the obstacles were. The biggest object there is a bunker that could hold 1,000 German troops. They dug them way down into the earth after all the artillery was done, and they could come back out of there and then be ready to fight without having lost any men. You can walk through the woods today and still find machine gun emplacements. The land had been so much fought over and shelled by artillery, you can see it down there. Awfully hard to progress through there. And then they had dug in artillery and many tanks, so forth. The key to getting to crashing through was to capture this facility. In 1916, at the Battle of Verdun, the Crown Prince of Germany, Wilhelm, had created this observatory. He had taken a naval periscope, put a very powerful telescope on the top, concealed it in that house, and he could spot artillery anywhere on this battlefield. And if they didn't capture that, they could blast the Americans to kingdom come. There was no way. So they decided that that contraption had to fall. They didn't know exactly where it was on the hill, but they knew it was up there. It was on a butte called the Butte of Montfaucon. And the book is called, my book is called Little Gibraltar, Betrayal at Little Gibraltar. This was known to be the hardest part of the Western Front. It was a fortified area. The plan, because it was such a hardened area, was to have two divisions attack it. One, the 79th, would mount a holding attack on the front, while the 4th Division, which was in another corps, would encircle it from the rear. And once it was encircled, it couldn't continue. They would have given up or fled. They gave it the task to two divisions, and it's called a turning maneuver. And that maneuver, the weaker of the divisions does a holding attack, putting pressure on the front, and then the other divisions, it goes around, makes an end run around, and encircles it. There's a flaw here. And the flaw was that there were two major generals involved. The 79th Division belonged to a corps that was headed by George Cameron, a major general, two-star general. The 4th Division was headed by another corps commander, and that was Robert E. Lee Bullard. So that was the flaw. Would they cooperate? They were ordered to cooperate to do this. Now what happened? The 4th Division did not support the attack on Montfaucon. It went right on by and came within probably 400 yards of the base of the butte, but just kept on going in a very easy sector. The sector that 79th had was very tough. As battles go, the generals started pushing on the 79th. You got to take this hill. You got to take it. So they tried to do this, but they were held up by one day. And that one day slowed up the Meuse-Argonne offensive so much that it never met its objective, never. And you won't read that in many, many history books. Meuse-Argonne is said to be a big victory, but it never cut that rail line that it was supposed to do. By the way, General Cameron, who was a mild-mannered fellow, it turns out his son was head of Stanton Military Academy, and he was demoted to colonel and sent home to Stanton. He died in Stanton. Now, it was indeed a deadly delay. General Galwitz, who was the German commander, wrote that already in the evening of the first day, the danger was averted because we got the Germans to come up, the reinforcements to come up. That incident stalled the offensive for 2.5 to 3 weeks. And because of that, you know, you measure time in military affairs by deaths. And on the Western Front, 122,000 men were wounded or killed during that period. So that's a rough equivalent what this incident cost. Pershing eventually proclaimed victory, and we celebrated the big victory, but they never reached the town of Sedan and captured that rail line. And so I needed to find, I got this far, and I said, well, it's a significant thing, you know, could be a significant thing. But how did I know that Parkin was telling the truth? Well, this fell into my lap. I went to Pershing's memoirs, and I found, lo and behold, that there was a statement in the memoirs about this incident, and it talked about a misinterpretation of orders. But here's what I found. I went to the Library of Congress. I found that the drafts of the memoirs were at the Library of Congress, and I went there and I found them. Lo and behold, the man who wrote the draft chapter on the Meuse-Argonne was Eisenhower. He had not been in World War I, but he was on Pershing's staff following the war. And he wrote about this in a very frank way. He said, The 4th Division failed to turn Monfalcone on the first day. And that's fairly blunt language. In Pershing's hand on this draft, nobody's ever gone and looked at it, I suppose. He changed that using obfuscating wording and passive voice so that you could not tell what happened. He changed it in his hand, he crossed it out and substituted through some misinterpretation of the orders of the First Army, the opportunity to capture Monfalcone that day was lost. No agency there, passive voice, doesn't say who misinterpreted the orders, just leaves it that way. I think of that as a smoking gun. He has covered it up. He's not going to tell the truth. After the war, a man who was in the 4th Division, his name is Ewing Booth, had never been to the military academies, by the way, was at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, which is the graduate school for the Army. It's where the people who are going to come up to be commanders go, officers. He overheard a lecture in which the man who was the chief of staff for General Pershing said that the victory would have been grander, more grand, if they had only, if the 4th Division had only supported the 79th more. He was furious about this because he was in the 4th and he had seen all these shenanigans back and forth. He knew what had happened. He knew that the 4th had been ordered, Bullard had ordered them just to continue on. But he didn't like the fact that his division was getting besmirched. So he began, on his own, a 20-year investigation of the matter. And he sent letters out to his friends who had been generals and colonels in the battle, saying, hey, what do you remember about this? And he gets them on the record. And luckily, even though I think I hate to say this, but I think the people at the National Archives did not want to give me this file. I did not know about it. I went there one day. I talked to the two senior archivists, told them what I was doing, what I was interested in, Monfalcone. They never mentioned General Booth's file. Talked to a young guy, you know, 25, who's just coming out of school, and he said to me, he said, did you know we have a file here called Monfalcone, and it's about this very issue? I said, no. And he said, would you like to see it? And I said, yes, I would. That file is not kept where the rest of the files are kept. It's kept in the office of the chief archivist. The chief World War I archivist, whom I had spoken to about this, and didn't get any response. Now, Booth goes after this. To show you how intent he was, people warned him, said, you're ruffling feathers here. There are people who don't want this discussed. And of course, he was back, he was not demoted, but he was back to his regular rank, which was colonel, and he wanted to be a general again. He knew he was running a risk, but this is what he wrote back to this guy. I'm going to push this thing to a solution now while we are all still alive and remember the instances. I don't want our grandchildren to cuss us out for being responsible for the failure of the 3rd and 5th Corps to reach the Army objective September 26th as we cuss out our ancestors for similar features in the Civil War. He knew what had happened. And this file is about 75 letters thick. And it, if you read it carefully, it's not an easy thing to read. You gotta, I spent 2 or 3 months just getting through it. And it tells the whole story. What Booth discovered was that Bullard had been ordered to enter Cameron's zone to turn Monfalcone. That was the issue, whether or not he could cross that thin little line, whether or not he'd been ordered to do that. We'll talk about that in a second. He later claimed that the order from Pershing and his staff was unclear, but he never asked for clarification. He just rewrote it. And he rewrote it so that he just charged ahead without helping the 79th. During that delay, and it was about a 24-hour delay that it caused, the German reinforcements came and Bullard didn't make it much farther, so it stalled him too, and it stalled the whole U.S. Army. Now, here are the orders, and there is confusion caused by a prepositional phrase. The original order, by promptly penetrating the hostile second position. Now, that means going through a line, which gives Bullard the chance to misinterpret. It, Bullard's corps, will turn Montfaucon. Now, turn means, coming around behind it. And the section of the hostile second position within the zone of action of the V Corps, thereby assisting in the capture of the hostile second position west of Montfaucon. It's on the other side from where the fourth was. Bullard had it rewritten, and this is the way he had it rewritten. Fourth will push attack vigorously regardless of the 79th progress. The fourth will assist the 79th by turning Montfaucon, and here are the words, not by advance into the area of the 79th, as he'd been ordered to do, but by going as hard as they could toward the front. And that's what did it. And that's in writing. You can find it. So Bullard is arguing that all he had to do was just go through it. That would help the 79th. But he ignored the wording that said you need to encircle it. And what I say is the orders can be misread if you want to misread them and if you ignore that second part. But it's right in the first sentence. Bullard was no slave to orders. Here he is. I've never seen the memoirs of anybody who was more self-impeaching than General Bullard. He bragged about being reprimanded 6 times for disobeying orders in his career, and he just says, I was right each time, and I'd do it again. He sneered at Pershing for honoring the orders that he got. I mean, his former commanding officer, and this was published. He said he disliked complex attacks like encirclements. You've got to take the enemy head on. That's the only way to do it. And his motive was to gain command, to win command of the 2nd U.S. Army. He knew the two guys were up for that command, Cameron or Bullard. And he knew if he helped Cameron take Montfaucon, Cameron would be the hero. So he said, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to set a record for as far as I can go, and that'll capture attention. And he needed to take down Cameron, and he did that. He was, during the war, right at the end, he was promoted to command the 2nd Army. He got a 3rd star. He was one of the top four in the American Expeditionary Force. He came back. He became, as people do, he became the president of a NGO that pushed military preparedness. And then he began to talk like our president, current president. He warned about radical professors and Mexican revolutionaries, and he proposed arming citizens to repel any invasion of the country. He made a big mistake, though, by appearing in this advertisement that ran in Time magazine and elsewhere. He wore his uniform and all of his medals, and you see, that's what Harry Parker was talking about. He got all the high military honors from Britain, France, Germany, or not Germany, but Belgium and the U.S. And he appeared in that and endorsed Lucky Strike cigarettes, and the Army landed on him. They said, you cannot do that. You cannot wear your uniform and endorse a product. And he was sort of scorned thereafter. Harry Parkin came back. He went to Los Angeles. He became really successful. The land boom was underway. And he was part of it, and he became very wealthy. Lived in Hollywood. Beverly Hills hadn't been really developed all that much at that point, so he lived in Hollywood but had a fabulous house. He got the DSC in 1924, had bad limp from his wounds, hard time getting around. And his grandson said, my grandfather never had a good day after World War I. And I think what happened is he started drinking. He also told me, I said, do you remember a name that I'm just going to tell you? He didn't remember. He didn't know about all this stuff. But I said, General Bullard. And he said, yeah. He said, when that name came up, my grandfather would get angry and just clam up. He considered suicide, and he lived only a mile from General Booth, who knew the truth, but they never met each other. And he died in 1948. Now, after the war, General Pershing became the head of the American Battle Monuments Commission. He planned all the cemeteries and all the monuments, and he designated Montfaucon to be the monument, the primary monument. It's the biggest. And by the way, this was designed by the same guy who did the Washington or the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, John Russell Pope. Quite a designer. I mean, this was really significant. It's 225 feet tall, sits out in the middle of nowhere. Nowhere. I'm telling you, it's like finding a cow pasture. And but it's an interesting place because all the fortifications, a lot of them are still in place. A lot of bunkers, concrete bunkers. There's very little mention of the 79th Division in this. The 79th wanted to put up a much smaller memorial, and divisions were allowed to do that. They were not allowed to do it. They put up another memorial, the 316th, which was one of their regiments, where Harry Parkin was wounded. They put up another one. It's another fortified hill. Pershing went to the French government and said, I want you to tear this monument down, destroy this monument. The French government was just taken aback. Why would you want to do that? You know, the guys collected the money. Turns out that the men had the foresight to buy the land the monument was on. And the French government said, we can't tear it down. It's on private property. And it's still there. In a guidebook to the battlefields, which Eisenhower worked on, they have scrubbed that book clean of any references to the 79th. I mean, it shows up on maps, but it doesn't talk about it, what it did. And the monument that Pershing wanted to take down, they say, this is a monument to elements that fought in this area. They don't even name the element, you know, the division. So I come back to this. You know, you can hide things in plain sight. And I'm wondering if this big monument celebrates a victory or is it hiding a debacle? And believe me, if you go back in Civil War history, and I've seen this in place at Chickamauga, the people who became congressmen after the war dictated where the monuments were going to go. And they did not put places that would have been embarrassing to them. So, Booth, in 1948, Booth finished this file. He'd been working on it 20 years. And he wrote this note, and it's if you understand, you'll see it's really impassioned. He covered the file with this. Thus there is ended a research of thousands of pages of records and interviews with hundreds of officers covering a period of 20 years in an effort to determine who at 3rd Army Corps gave the orders which prevented the 4th Division from assisting capture of Montfaucon. He never drew the conclusion. He lets these documents speak for themselves. This is why it's so horrible. You know, I mean, 10 million deaths, 20 million wounded, thousands are missing, and I describe in the book one of the soldiers that fought with Park, and it has a lot of narratives from various soldiers, was wounded in the Meuse-Argonne, and they picked him up. He was wounded through the chest, and they knew that he had it was probably a fatal wound. But they said goodbye to him, and they got four prisoners to carry him back toward a field hospital. And as Parkin was watching, see, about 100 yards back, a German shell landed right on the stretcher, vaporized the whole group. Just, they were gone. And the only thing they found was one rubber heel. And that's where the missing came from. And if you see, there were more, significantly more missing soldiers in World War I than any war before that because of this ability. 50,000 U.S. dead, 205 were wounded, 205,000. Shell shock showed up, of course, you know that. It was a lost generation. Five empires crumble, and I try to trick people, and they don't think of it. Didn't happen to the British Empire right away, but it started right then, and they were out of business in the next 20 years, 30 years. Marriage of science and weaponry. I just finished an article about the German who invented phosgene gas, who was a Jew, by the way, and when Hitler took over, he was going to have the guy arrested, and he escaped to Switzerland. So. And then standing general staff, isolationism, fascism, communism come about. And then here's what I was talking about with Versailles, the peace treaty. One of the things that Wilson proclaimed was self-determination. And self-determination has gotten a mind of its own. I mean, you all know what's going on in Catalonia now, trying to break away from Spain. But all of these places were set up in hopes that it would create a stable world. And what happened is just falling apart. So everything you see in the Middle East was set up as a result of World War I. And I call it the most significant event in the 20th century, and I do think it is. Harry wrote, I think, what's got to be the benediction, and this is a very sad passage. He was writing about one of his friends who had gotten killed. Are we that survived to become old men in time, are we the fortunate ones, or are those who died in the full flush of youth doing something wonderfully fine and heroic, are they the fortunate ones? Sometimes I wonder, and were it not for those near and dear to us, whom we want to care for and protect, I wonder if I would wonder.
Wow, that quote from Harry Parkin at the end of Bill Walker's talk is always just like...
Yeah, no, it's really, really something to think about.
It's so heart-wrenching. And I think it just, I mean, like he says, it's the, what did he call it? The benediction for the war, more or less? That it,
oh, yeah.
Such a horrible event and just...
Kind of, was it worth it?
Right. So on that very...
somber note.
Yes.
We're going to close for today. Thank you again for listening. This podcast has been brought to you through generous support of the Friends of the Library. If you would like to join the Friends of the Library or learn more, go to jmrlfriends.org. The link will be in our show notes.
We'll be back in 2 weeks for another episode. But in the meantime, thanks for tuning in, and we're glad to be on the same page. I didn't read any books.
You said you were reading a book.
I don't know what book I'm reading.